And so the question is, how does tradition relate to non-traditional Jews? This is a crucially important question.
Having thought together about prayer and repentance, we now move together into the fifth lecture in our series. What are we going to think about?
I think we live our lives in a series of concentric circles. We obviously begin with ourselves as individuals, and then we move on to an engagement with the other. And the other could be first family, and then it extends from family to community. And what I would like to take a look at in this next presentation is the power, the force, the centrality, the focus on the individual. After all, that's where it all begins. But then also to note that the individual lives in a larger context, and to try to think about examining the nature of the relationship between an individual and the larger space that that individual occupies and within which that individual lives. In particular, I'd like to develop Rabbi Soloveitchik's notion of a conceptual place within the world of Judaism for Jews who are not observant. This is a major controversy in the contemporary Jewish community. The nature of the relationship between various denominations and various religious backgrounds, generally unfolding not in an area of a great deal of respect and empathy and sensitivity and kindness and warmth. Rabbi Soloveitchik provides us with a model that's extremely important to recognize that while there are Jews who do not observe and live a life of Torah and mitzvot, a life of law and commandments that was so central to Rabbi Soloveitchik, but there is a place for these Jews. There is a conceptual underpinning that gives meaning and authenticity to their space. And that is a voice that is really important in the contemporary Jewish community and provides a model for all religious traditions about how does a religious tradition relate to those, whatever that may be, who are not fully in consonance with the demands, the requirements, the expectations that are perceived of by the faithful as a sine qua non for being a part of that religious tradition. It should by now be clear that the individual is central in the thought of Rabbi Soloveitchik. As I already had the occasion more than once to note, Rabbi Soloveitchik formulated much of his thought and much of his philosophy in the context of presenting various human types, human typologies. There's halachic man, the lonely man of faith. I mentioned Rosh Hashanah man, Yom Kippur man, and so on. All of these are obviously categories or designations relating to an individual. In addition, in the last unit, we already encountered Rabbi Soloveitchik's emphasis on the individual experience of prayer and repentance. It's obvious that the individual is the one who prays, and it's the individual who engages in repentance. The individual is central for Rabbi Soloveitchik. Source number one, the halacha's concern with man, and again, the word man, the halacha's concern with man is mainly centered on the individual. This comes from a collection of essays that I already had occasion to mention to you, published posthumously. There are now about 8 or 9 such volumes, a collection of essays that were found in Rabbi Soloveitchik's files, prepared by a team of scholars under the auspices of his daughters, This particular one is entitled Out of the Whirlwind, Essays on Mourning, Suffering, and the Human Condition. We already had a chance to talk about suffering a little bit earlier, but there's a lot more here. There's a lot more everywhere about everything that I've been trying to convey to you. The halakha's concern with man is mainly centered on the individual. Man is neither an idea, like, quote, humanity, whose praise Plato and the Greek philosopher sang, nor a supra-individual unity, like, quote, society or community, which many philosophical systems, including that of Marxism, have idealized or idolized. They sang the praise of society, which is a supra-individual unity. That's what they did. The halakha, parenthesis by contrast, insists that nothing, not the idea nor the collective, should supplant the single, transient, and frail individual, quote, who is here today and tomorrow is in the grave, who today is here on the platform and the next day who knows where he will end up. He, the individual, occupies a dominant position in the halakha, and his role, the individual's role, is central and indispensable. Of course, the halakha has not overlooked the community, particularly the community of the committed and the elected as the bearers of the divine eternal message. Yet the individual constitutes a reality whose ontic legitimacy, ontic comes from Heidegger, and it means something like physical or actual existence, whose ontic legitimacy, whose physical or actual existence and legitimacy must not be questioned, and whose interests, namely the interest of the individual, the halakha, like a devoted mother, had at heart. In a talk that he delivered and is summarized in this volume entitled Reflections of the Rav. This was published during Rabbi Soloveitchik's lifetime. There was a rabbi by the name of Abraham Besdin who was sitting, listening, and he wrote up and summarized the teaching of Rabbi Soloveitchik. It's not a transcript. It's not word for word. Rabbi Soloveitchik did not examine it in advance of publication, but nevertheless, it is considered to be authoritative by Rabbi Soloveitchik scholars. In this volume, there is an essay, source number 2, entitled, Which Comes First, God or People? Now, by God, in this essay, as we will see momentarily, doesn't really mean God, but he means commitment to God. He means an individual living a spiritual life in commitment with and in following of the commandments that that individual believes were given by God. And the question that he poses is, which one comes first? And we see immediately at the beginning when he poses the question that in fact it is not a God-human dimension or dialectic or dichotomy. It is an individual-people dichotomy. A religious Jew makes two commitments: to observe the mitzvot, the laws of the Torah, that's the personal and the individual, and also to identify with the historical destiny of his people. When a candidate for conversion appears before a religious court and declares her or his intention to join the Jewish fold, she or he is asked two questions. Two questions. Number one, what motivates you? Do you not realize that we're a persecuted people? Why do you want to be a part of the Jewish people? So there's a people question. And the answer is, I do want to be a part of the Jewish people. We may have challenges. The Jewish people may be persecuted, may be hated, but I'm ready to hitch my wagon to the world of the Jewish people. So there's a people question. And then there's a second question to the prospective convert. A couple of lines down. The second question deals with the acceptance of the discipline and the sovereignty of Jewish law. Are you prepared to do this? Are you prepared to commit to do that? Are you prepared to commit not to do something else? There's a very specific focus on aligning with and committing to a particular set of practices. That's the second question. Here, the convert prospective convert makes a commitment to live a lonely life in the larger family of man, becoming a member of a minority people in a society which is often cynical and which in general hardly encourages our distinct way of life. Society doesn't understand us. So on the one hand, there's a commitment to a people. On the other hand, there's a commitment to a way of life. And here the question is, which of these is the greater consequence to Jewish survival? The personal, legal mitzvah commitment or the national commitment to peoplehood? We're not implying that either may be rejected. We need both. Both are required, but which one takes precedence? And in the course of this talk, which turned into this essay, Rabbi Soloveitchik concludes, as we continue in source number two, he concludes the following. First, in the middle of the paragraph, towards the end of source number two, first, the Jew must commit himself or herself totally as a single being to a disciplined Torah life. He is to exhibit his commitment daily in the myriad details of every activity. The halacha knows nothing of trivial matters. In every detail, it demands absolute obedience. So number one in terms of value, most important is sign on to live a committed Jewish life. Action, individual. This is my own personal commitment. Next comes the community, the people, the state. The relationship between the Jew and God is central. It precedes his relationship with his people. So we have individual and we have community, we have peoplehood, and it's clear, and that's the point of departure for this presentation, that individual is central. And I've tried to give you a number of ways how I understand this and how I appreciate it. However, as we've already also seen, community is also important. And this tension between individual and community is outlined at the very beginning of Rabbi Soloveitchik's article entitled The Community, source number three. This is one of a number of articles I already referred to earlier that he published all together in one issue of the journal called Tradition in 1978. Source number three, the very instant we pronounce the word community, we recall by sheer association the ancient controversy between collectivism and individualism. Willy-nilly, one of the most favorite phrases of Rabbi Soloveitchik, I hear it in my willy-nilly, which means sort of automatically, it just happens, willy-nilly. And I'm actually surprised to see it in writing because it's not a sort of a fancy, we've encountered fancy writing, willy-nilly. The old problem of who and what comes first, and that's the problem that we're now addressing in this unit, the old problem of who and what comes first, metaphysically, not chronologically, arises. Is the individual an independent free entity who gives up basic aspects of his sovereignty in order to live within a communal framework? Or is the reverse true? The individual is born into the community, which in turn invests him with certain rights. This perennial controversy is still unresolved. I just want to note in passing that in both options, it's really the individual that continues to be the focus. And we'll come back to this. Let us ask a simple question. What does Judaism say about this conflict? And let us give a simple answer. Judaism rejects both alternatives. Neither theory per se is true. Both experience that of, and here he defines it as aloneness, different than lonely. We've encountered lonely. Now we have aloneness, as well as that of togetherness, are inseparable basic elements of the I awareness. The Bible tells us that God created a single individual. So in terms of the way the world unfolded, it starts with one person. It starts with an individual. The Bible also tells us that the Almighty, having created Adam, also created Eve. So, question, who comes first? the community, the pair, or man or woman alone. Who takes precedence? Adam and Eve in the utter loneliness with which both of them experienced at the hour of creation, namely separate as individuals, or Adam and Eve as a couple after they have been brought together to become united in marriage? We saw already at the beginning of Lonely Man of Faith how Rabbi Soloveitchik spends a lot of time analyzing the story of creation. It was centrally important to him. We're going to be coming back to that again in Unit 7, where in his article Confrontation at the beginning, he has an entirely different take than he had in Lonely Man of Faith on the whole story of the two stories of creation. And here he's back to it again. We begin in the beginning. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. In the beginning, God created one human being. Then God created another human being. And now all of a sudden, we have a community. We now have two human beings. Do we see each one of them individually as being centrally significant? Or are now we're looking at the two of them together, the beginnings of what will become a much larger community. As we have indicated before, both the community related and the lonely individual, be he man, be she woman, were created by God. Hence, it would be absurd to equate the biblical doctrine with either philosophical alternative. The answer to the problem is rather a dialectical one. Very, very important word for Rabbi Soloveitchik. Namely, it is rarely an either-or proposition. It is highly rarely an either-or proposition, but it's both at the same time, and they could be in opposition to one another. They could be mutually exclusive, but somehow they both coexist simultaneously. We saw this dialectical tension in the relationship between Adam 1 and Adam 2. Typologically, they're very different. They're opposites, but yet they both coexist in every human being. So they're both there in tension with one another simultaneously. One doesn't negate the other. One somehow has to live, comma, in tension, comma, with the other. And here we have the same thing. So individual and community are not the same thing. And they're very different and they're mutually exclusive. Either it's an individual or it's a community, but somehow it's both. And they both live with one another and both of them are central. Both of them are part of creation, and we have to figure out how to do that, and that is precisely, as he continues to say, what makes man great. What makes a human great is that the human being is precisely the sum total of both of these conflicting sentiments or both of these conflicting realities. In fact, the greatness of man manifests itself in his inner contradiction. Rabbi Soloveitchik was very comfortable living in contradiction. He never felt the need to sort of work it all out. I got it now, we're gonna wrap it up, and now everything is good, perfect, beautiful, fine. No, there's a lot of tension, and the tension remains. Much of his thought is devoted to explaining the tension, to teasing out the tension, not to resolving the tension. In fact, the greatness of man manifests itself in his inner contradiction, in his dialectical nature, in his being single and unrelated to anyone, as well as, parenthesis, at the exact very same time, and parenthesis, in his being thou related and belonging to a community structure. Once again, notice that the locus is the individual. On either side of the equation, the subject of the sentence is the individual. So is the individual alone, or is the individual part of a community? So even when projecting or trying to explain the concept of community, he's not looking at it as this super construct in and of itself, but it's a collection of individuals. So the individual still continues to retain centrality, as we saw at the beginning, where he actually explicitly says that it's the individual that's the focus, even more so than that of community. Having noted that community is central and that both are important, both the individual and the community, and the individual being a part of the community, Rabbi Soloveitchik then in this essay proceeds to describe a series of communities. When we talk about community, what does community mean? How do you define community? It's not just an aggregate number of people, even an aggregate number or a collection of like-minded people. What does it mean to be a community? Source number four. Once I have recognized the thou and invited the thou, the other person, to join the community, I ipso facto assume responsibility for the thou. So the next step is, once the community is created, then it's not just that we're living next to one another and we're living, this person is living here and this person is living here, but there's actually now a sense of responsibility that's created one towards the other. There's something that brings me together with that person. Recognition is identical with commitment. Here again, we walk in the ways of our Maker. God created man. When God created man, he didn't abandon him. God showed concern for him. God cared for Adam. God said, it's not good for man to be alone, provided him with a mate, placed him in paradise, allowed him to enjoy the fruit of the garden. Even after he sinned, he allowed him to enjoy the benefit of God's blessing. God still continued to take care of him. He was concerned with man even while man was in sin. God assumed responsibility. So just like God assumed responsibility, so as soon as there is a second human being, then the first human being and the second human being are in a state of responsibility towards one another. And that only continues to expand as the number of people expands. The notion of I'm not living on an island by myself. If there's something, someone else, then I need to be, quote, responsible for that person. Source number five, assuming responsibility leads to the creation of a particular kind of community. So now it's not just me and it's not just you, but we are now a community. We're connected to one another. When the I becomes aware of his being responsible for the well-being of the thou, whom he has helped bring into existence, a new community emerges, the community of prayer. What does this mean? What does it mean to be in a community of prayer? It means a community of common pain, of common suffering. The halacha, here again, centrality, the halacha, the halacha. It's just such a looming word and concept for him, as we saw particularly in Unit 2, but it repeats itself constantly. The halacha has taught the individual to include his fellow man in his prayer. The individual must not limit himself to his own needs, no matter how pressing those needs are and how distinguished that person may be. Halacha has formulated prayer in the plural. There's hardly a prayer which avails itself of the grammatical singular. Even private prayers, such as those offered on the occasion of sickness, death, or other crises, are recited in the plural. In the previous unit, we saw the prayer entitled the 18 benedictions, the 19 benedictions, and they're formulated in the plural. So there is such a thing, once we understand that another person exists, once we understand that we see ourselves as part of a community, once we have a sense of responsibility, in other words, our focus transcends just us alone, but is engaged with the other, then next thing, willy-nilly, we move to a prayerful community. A prayerful community means that I pray for you. I'm not just responsible for you. What does it mean that I'm responsible for you? It means first that I pray for you, that your pain is my pain, your concern is my concern. And then we move to source number six, to the next community. The prayer community, it is evident, must at the same time be a charity community. I mean, it's really nice to pray for somebody else, and Rabbi Soloveitchik believed that prayer matters, that prayer has an effect, that prayer somehow is efficacious, but that alone is not enough. I need to actually physically demonstrate my responsibility to you, not only by praying for you, but by helping you. Charity community. It is not enough to feel the pain of many, nor is it sufficient to pray for the many, parenthesis, as exalted and as central and as important as it is, end parenthesis, if this does not lead to charitable action. Hence, Knesset Yisrael. It's a phrase that Rabbi Soloveitchik uses often to describe the national juridical entity of the Jewish people. Hence, the Jewish people is not only a prayerful community, but also a charitable community. We give. We pray for all because we are sensitive to pain. We try to help the many. And he continues to talk about how the notion of kindness, or the quality of kindness, is a trait that is part of the personality of the DNA of the Jew. We don't only pray, our sense of responsibility expresses itself in charity, and framed here not as an individual act or responsibility, but we are now deeply rooted in a community. So we have a prayerful community and we have a charity community. And then, source number 7, we move to a teaching community. The prayerful charity community, all of this in Rabbi Soloveitchik's article entitled The Community, started as a lecture published in 1978. The prayerful charity community rises to a higher sense of communion in the teaching community, where the teacher and disciple are fully united. Now, what he does here is describe the teaching community. And I would like to take an extra moment to read what he says, because I believe that here one finds, I'm not going to say most clearly, but very clearly clarified or described Rabbi Soloveitchik's conception of his major role, of his personal major role. He identified himself often as, I am a teacher. The word in Yiddish is melamed. It comes from the Hebrew to learn, to teach. He identified himself as a teacher. What does it mean to be a teacher? And again, teaching here is not presented as an individual activity. Yes, there is a teacher. The teacher is a person, but it's a teaching community. The teacher can't teach to the teacher himself. The teacher needs to engage others in the act of teaching. And so we have an individual, we have a community. Individual, community, equal responsibility. Responsibility leads to a prayerful community, a prayer community. It leads to a charity community. And now we are in the world of what he describes in source number 7 as a teaching community. What does the teacher do? And if I may be so bold, I would rephrase this: what is it that I do? Or what is it that I'm really interested in doing? He tells a story, and what he says is really beautiful. So even if it wasn't what I believe to be a real self-reflection of his core identity, it's worth reading. And again, I keep on saying, so how does it fit with us? How does it fit with our lives? And even if we're not a teacher, we don't have to make a living being a teacher, but we're all teachers. We all have a role of being a teacher, whether it's in a family, whether it's in a group of friends, whatever community we're a part of. You don't have to be a teacher to be a teacher. So what does it mean to be a teacher? What does the teacher do? He tells a story. What is the nature of the story that has been told and retold hundreds of times through the generations? We tell the children the story of laws. What do we start with? What's the first story? Laws. We tell the children the story of laws, which form the foundation of Jewish morality. We tell them the story of honesty and sincerity, love and sympathy. This story is meant to teach the child not to steal, not to lie, not to be vindictive. We also try to tell the child the story of statutes whose meaning we do not fully grasp. So I get that I can't lie, and I get that I can't cheat, and I get that I can't steal, and I get that I can't be vindictive, but there is a whole segment of law that we transmit to the child that we don't understand. We don't get it. I mentioned earlier, in an earlier unit, the phrase, and I'll repeat it in Hebrew and translate it, ta'amei ha-mitzvot. I translate it as the reason for the commandments, the rationale for the commandments. Remember, Rabbi Soloveitchik asked that on a question in his undergraduate final exam, and then he came back to it in his letter to Rabbi Leo Young as the title of the essay that he was interested in writing about. This is really important to him. What's the rationale? And sometimes I get it, and sometimes I just don't get it. And that's okay, because I do it anyway. But I'd love to get it, but it just is beyond my comprehension. We tell the child those stories also, the story of those laws as well, whose meaning we do not fully grasp. We tell him the story of laws whose rationale is beyond our grasp, of man's surrender to his maker, the story of the suspension of human judgment in deference to a higher will. I don't do it because I get it. I don't do it because I understand it. I don't get it because I realize how this is going to help me. I'm doing it because God told me to do it. I surrender to God's will. I do what God tells me to do. Extra bonus if I could get it. I don't get it. Okay, I'm going to do it anyway. We also tell the child the story of a people who met God and joined him in a covenant, not just laws, whether we understand the law, whether we don't understand the law. We tell the child the story of people who met God and joined God in a covenant to engage the Almighty in a dialogue. We tell the child the story of our past. We help the child develop a historical memory. We train the child not to forget past events. We tell the child the story of our confrontation with God in the desert. We urge the child not to forget our liberation from bondage and our encounter with Amalek. Amalek defined here as the destructive Satan. According to Rabbi Soloveitchik, anyone who is determined to destroy Jews is considered to be an Amalek. It's an ancient tribe described in the Bible who attacked or which attacked Jews on their shortly after they left Egypt, but it's not an ethnic designation, it's more of a conceptual designation. You want to go after Jews, you are considered to be an Amalek, a destructive Satan. And we teach that to our children. We teach the child to be loyal to those memories, to a land, to a sanctuary, etc. We not only tell stories, it's not just stories, stories about laws or stories about events or experiences. We tell stories precipitating the re-experience of those events. It's not just historical memory. This is something that we remember that happened a long time ago, but it's something that we are bidden to and transmit the value of and teach our children to themselves re-experience on a constant basis, to re-experience the events which transpired even millennia ago. To tell a story is to relive the event. We still sit on the floor and mourn the destruction of the sanctuary, an event which took place 1900 years ago, over 1900 years ago. We still celebrate the Exodus, an event which lies at the dawn of our history. We have a whole ritual on a whole holiday, on Passover, designed not just to remember the Exodus, but to actually relive the Exodus. Our stories are concerned not only with the past, but of the future as well. We tell our children the story of patient waiting for the great realization of the promise, no matter how slow the realization is in coming. In short, it is an exciting story that we tell them. I really do believe that Rabbi Soloveitchik here is telling his own story. This is what I do. This is what interests me. This is what animates me. And that's why it's so relevant to me, because I think this is not just an objective analysis, but it's really a personal, self-reflective journey or reflection or encounter that he's trying to describe. It is the story of a teaching community which cuts across the ages, encompassing people who lived millennia ago, who made their contribution to Knesset Yisrael, to the entity known as the Jewish people, and who have left the stage. We also tell them the story of people who at some point in the distant future will enter the historical stage. It's not just about the past. It's also about the future. Our story unites countless generations, past, present, past, and future merge into one great experience. Contrary to the popular medieval adage, which he quotes in the footnote, our story tells of a glorious past that is still real because it has not vanished, a future which is already here, and a creative present replete with opportunity and challenge. In other words, there's a merging here. There's a merging of past, present, and future. Past merges into present, future merges into present, and they all get expressed in the teaching community, in what it is that we transmit to the next generation. It is a privilege and a pleasure, I'm going to add parenthesis for me, end parenthesis. I don't mean me, I mean Rabbi Soloveitchik, but I do mean me too. It is a privilege and a pleasure to belong to such a, and here, summary, after individual, after Adam and Eve, after responsibility comes, prayerful, charitable, and teaching community, which feels the breath of eternity. In source number 8, Rabbi Soloveitchik describes another kind of a community, which to my mind is really identified with what he referred to just now, and which I described in great detail, as the teaching community. We're back to the eulogy that he gave for his, parenthesis, I don't really have a word in English to describe exactly what this relationship is, end parenthesis, namely the mother of his son-in-law, his older son-in-law, Professor Tversky, was my teacher. His mother was a very significant figure in obviously Professor Tversky's life, but also in Rabbi Soloveitchik's life. Rabbi Soloveitchik's daughter married her son, and they both lived in Boston. They both lived pretty much next to one another. I mentioned at some point that Professor Tversky not only was the Litauer professor at Harvard, but also was a Hasidic Rebbe. He was a rabbi of a small congregation in Brookline, and the congregation met in the home where his mother lived. His mother lived there, and that's where the congregation met, and Rabbi Soloveitchik would be there all the time, with the exception of, I told you, from Tuesday morning until Thursday night when he'd be flying off to teach in New York. And his mother, Professor Tversky's mother, never missed a service. She came to the morning service, she came to the afternoon service, she came to the evening service, and so she was there all the time. I mean, I remember her, I saw her every single day in the first couple of years. She never missed a service herself. So Rabbi Soloveitchik saw her pretty much every single day, and they had a relationship, and he had a lot of respect for her, and described that respect in this eulogy, and not only in this eulogy. If you go back and look at the top of the community article, he says, I am dedicating the community article that I just read to you to the memory of this particular woman. So here, in the course of his eulogy, which was not delivered at the funeral, it was delivered after 30 days. There was a 30-day period of mourning in traditional Jewish law when there's a transition from more intense mourning to less intense mourning. And so that is marked often by some kind of a memorial reflection. The memorial service is at the funeral, and then there's more of a reflection. It's less immediate. There's 30 days. There's a chance to sit back and be in a more objective position to assess the life and the legacy and the impact of the particular person who passed away. So it was 30 days later when there was such a gathering in this little small congregation. I had the privilege. I was a student of Professor Tversky. I was there. I remember it well. And Rabbi Soloveitchik said the following, with your permission, source 8, I wish to ask a strange question which a funeral orator or a eulogizer must address to the grieving congregation. Who was the Rebbetzin of Tolna? So she had her husband, who had passed away much earlier, was a Hasidic Rebbe of Tolna. That's the small town in Europe where they came from, and that's how they continued to identify themselves. So he was the Rebbe, and there is this nomenclature for the wife of the Rebbe, but not just an appendage to the husband, but also a significant figure in her own right, and that's known as Rebbetzin. Rebbetzin is wife of, and Rebbetzin is core significant identity in and of herself. So who was this person that I am now eulogizing? This noble woman who was snatched away from us so quickly. Next paragraph, if you should address this embarrassing question to me, I would answer she was an unusual woman. If you should continue to cross-examine me and insist that I clarify my use of the term unusual, it's fascinating. This is all part of his lecture. So you'd think he would have done this homework at home. So he would have already said, I can't say unusual because what does unusual mean? So he says, no, she is unusual. Then you're going to ask me, what's unusual? So then I'm going to tell you, I'll explain to you what unusual is. All of this unfolds in his presentation. It was mesmerizing because he takes you by the hand and he brings you along into his thought process. He was a very careful, deliberate public lecturer or public speaker. We could learn from this. It's not fourth draft done. It's working it through. And it doesn't lose anything. On the contrary, unusual, he's got your attention. She was an unusual woman. Okay. What does that mean? Ah! Oh my God! What does that mean? Ah! I'll tell you what that means. You're right there with him all the way through. 3.5 hours later, you haven't budged. You haven't budged. You're right in there. You're right in there. So what does it mean to be unusual? I would say she was unusual because she belonged to an unusual, next word, which is why this is here in source number 8, community. What is the name of that mysterious society? It is the Masora Society. Masora means tradition. Tradition means passing on values from generation to generation. She was a very central part of this particular society, which was founded by Moses at the dawn of our history, and which, at the point of eschatological fulfillment of our history, will be joined by the King Messiah, past and future. And she is the link. She is in the present. What characterizes that society? An unqualified dedication to learning and teaching. Teaching. It's a teaching society. Its motto is teach and let yourself be taught. It demands that every Jew be simultaneously a teacher and a pupil, that every member of the society hold on with one hand to an old teacher, while the other hand rest upon the frail shoulders of a young pupil. The society, which represents the very essence of Judaism, cuts across the ages and millennia and holds the key to our miraculous survival. And then he continues to say, people think that this is, I'm going to use a slang, a guy thing. People think that men are the ones who are the links in this tradition. People are mistaken. Rubric number 3, continuing in source number 8. People are mistaken in thinking that there is only one Masora and one Masora community, the community of the fathers. It is not true. We have two traditions, two communities, two what I am identifying as teaching communities. Here he refers to it as a Masora community, but he frames it in the context of teaching. We have two of them, the Masora or teaching community of the fathers and that of the mothers. And it is in this context, 3 paragraphs later, where he makes the point that we already saw earlier when he talks about his own mother and what do I know about mothers? Well, I had a mother and I'll share with you about my mother. And it is from my mother that I learned, quote, that Judaism consists not only of the formal compliance with the law, but the law as a living experience. It's the notion that it's not just the legal, but it's also the emotional, repeatedly emphasized as we have seen by Rabbi Soloveitchik. It's this emphasis on the emotion, on the feeling. I'm not a robot. I'm not a monkey. I'm a human being. I'm engaged in a romance. I'm engaged in a relationship. The relationship requires the totality of my being as a human being comes not from his father, but from his mother. You remember what he said? Had it not been for my mother, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. 23 tractates. He learned with his father, 10 hours a day, 10 years. He learned with his father and without his mother, he would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive, because his mother is integral to the Masora or teaching community. It's not just a man. It's not just the father. It's not just the grandfather. But the woman plays an extraordinarily significant role. So we have community for Rabbi Soloveitchik, which is extremely central. We have individual, we have Adam, and then we have Adam and Eve, and then we have responsibility, And then we have a prayer community, and then we have a charity community, and then we have a teaching or Masora community. There is a chapter, now source number 9, in his book entitled On Repentance. I showed you that book in the previous unit, where he describes so much about what does repentance mean. It's a summary of lectures that he delivered every single year, analyzing various chapters of the Code of Maimonides on the laws of repentance. There is a chapter entitled The Individual and the Community. This is an important aspect of Rabbi Soloveitchik's thinking. And he wrote as follows, underscoring particularly the importance of commitment to and engagement with community. A Jew who has lost faith, source number 9, in the peoplehood of Israel, the community of Israel, even though he may personally sanctify and purify himself by being strict in his observance of the precepts and by assuming prohibitions upon himself, okay, great, check, check, check in the sky, doing the mitzvot, following all of the commandments, beautiful, wonderful, but if such a Jew has lost faith in the importance of and connection to and commitment toward and responsibility for the community, described here as Knesset Yisrael, the congregation of Israel, such a Jew is incorrigible and totally unfit to join in the Day of Atonement, which encompasses the whole of the Jewish people and all its components and all its generations. So the Day of Atonement is a very important day. One walks into the Day of Atonement desiring atonement, and one does so as an individual and as part of a collective. And even though individually, check, 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 everything is great, you are nowhere, zero, nowhere, unless you identify with the collective. You are incorrigible and totally unfit to join in the Day of Atonement. Only the Jew who believes in Knesset Yisrael may partake of the sanctity of the day and the acquittal granted to him as part of the community of Israel. The Jew who believes in Knesset Yisrael is the Jew who lives as part of it, wherever it is, and is willing to give his life for it. It feels his pain, rejoices with it, fights in its wars, groans at its defeats, and celebrates its victories. So we have here the duality. You remember Rabbi Soloveitchik called it the dialectic. We started with the centrality of the individual. But it can't just be the individual. It has to be also the community and multiple layers of community. Multiple layers of community. It's a good question to ask ourselves. How would we describe ourselves, not just as individuals, but I think it would be fair to say that we consider ourselves part of community. So what communities are we a part of? How would we describe those circles? Are they concentric circles? Are they together circles? Are they coexisting as one within the other? Is there a hierarchy? Is there a rational hierarchy? Rabbi Soloveitchik, by presenting community this way, opens this up for us to consider in a very significant way. I want to make one additional point in this unit that I believe is particularly important in the 21st century, particularly within the Jewish community. Rabbi Soloveitchik grappled specifically with the meaning of Jewish peoplehood or Jewish community, or the way he describes it here is Knesset Yisrael. Knesset Yisrael, I mean in the broadest sense, the people of Israel. He grappled specifically, what does this mean in the 20th century when the reality is that most Jews are not observant? And most Jews are not observant from any traditional, and I'm going to use the word halachic, measure that Rabbi Soloveitchik would consider to be appropriate. Most Jews, 20th century did, 21st century continue, not live their lives in accordance with the dictates of traditional halacha. And so the question is, How does tradition relate to non-traditional Jews? This is a crucially important question. I feel that almost any time I say these words, or any time anyone will ever listen to these words, this will be an important burning issue right now in the community of Israel. What's the role, from a traditional Jewish perspective, of a Jew who does not live, from a traditional Jewish perspective, a traditional Jewish life? Is there a place for non-observant Jews or non-traditional Jews in traditional Jewish thought? One option is that, of course they're Jews. Obviously they're Jews. According to Jewish law, if your mother is a Jew, you're a Jew. But beyond a technical ethnic designation, one position is that this Jew has no intrinsic Jewish value for the Jewish life that this Jew has chosen to live. There is no way, according to this perspective, to justify such a lifestyle. Non-observance is not a legitimate option for many in traditional Jewish thought. The current Jewish identity of such a Jew as a Jew can't be a legitimate one. We can't legitimize this particular point of view, argues, this kind of behavior. It's not acceptable within the structure and within the worldview and within the legal understanding of traditional Jewish life. Rabbi Soloveitchik opened up a very interesting way how to look at this issue, once again, a very important and significant issue. And he developed a conceptual model for the non-observant, I don't even want to say secular, because it's not a secular. Secular means not religious at all. I'm talking about even Jews who do identify themselves as religious, but not religious in the sense that Rabbi Soloveitchik would have considered them to be in terms of a halachic lifestyle. He opened up for us a conceptual model for non-observant Jewish reality in the 20th and continuing into the 21st century. Source number 10. In his book, Fate and Destiny, we already saw this in unit number 2 when we talked about suffering and how he defined suffering in halachic categories. We are going to spend a lot of time in this work in our next unit, which is going to deal with Rabbi Soloveitchik's attitude towards Zionism and the state of Israel. Now I want to focus on this issue. This book is most identified with Rabbi Soloveitchik on Zionism. We are going to see that God is knocking. That's the Hebrew title of the book. More on this in unit number 6. At the door of the Jewish people with the founding of the State of Israel. But to simply describe this as a work on Zionism or the State of Israel is to miss huge, important aspects of this book and to fail to recognize how significant other pieces are. They're related to that, but they're extremely significant. And here I'm giving you an example, source number 10. The covenant at Sinai and the covenant at Egypt. When we probe the nature of our historical existence, and talking here now about we being the Jewish people, we being the plural, we being the people of Israel, or I will define it as the community of Israel, we arrive at a very important insight, one that constitutes a fundamental element of our worldview. The Torah relates, the Bible relates, that God made 2 covenants with the Israelites. The first covenant he made in Egypt. And in chapter 6 in the book of Exodus, the Bible says, "And I will take you to me, says God, for a people, and I will be to you a God." So this is a covenant. The covenant means there's one party and there's another party, and the two parties are now joined in sense of responsibility. There's a connection, there's a covenant between God and the Jewish people, covenant number 1, the covenant in Egypt. The second covenant, chronologically, second covenant, was with the Jews at Mount Sinai. And there in the 24th chapter of the book of Exodus, the Bible describes, again, a covenant, uses the word covenant, that God entered into with the Jewish people, and conversely, that the Jewish people entered into with God. What is the nature of these two covenants? So we've got two covenants. Why do you need two covenants? What's wrong with one covenant? God, Jewish people, we're good to go. No, two covenants. The Egypt covenant and the Sinai covenant. Why do I need two covenants? What is the nature of these two? If I have two, then they're significant. They're different from one another. What do they represent, each one? Seems to me that this question is implicitly answered at the beginning of our essay, where he talked about the difference between fate and destiny. That was the English, that is the English title of this book. For just as Judaism distinguishes between fate and destiny in the personal, individual realm, the person of fate is passive, is acted upon. The person of destiny is in charge of or wants to take control of that person's destiny. It's not just, you know, whatever happens, it is what it is, but I'm going to shape that. I'm going to proactively act to somehow frame or shape my destiny. Just as that applies to individuals, as he discussed earlier, so it differentiates between these two ideas, namely fate and destiny, in the sphere of our national historical existence. The individual is tied to his people both with the chains of fate and with the bonds of destiny. In light of this premise, it may be stated that the covenant of Egypt is a covenant of fate, the covenant at Sinai was a covenant of destiny. Now, what does this mean? The covenant of fate, I want to now tease out what Rabbi Soloveitchik describes. I don't want to just continue reading from him. I'm going to summarize now what he means by these two covenants. And I want to frame it specifically in this unit on the dialectical tension between individual and community, and to make a case and to somehow unpack Rabbi Soloveitchik's case for a place of non-observance in the peoplehood of Israel, an appropriate place. The covenant of fate is a covenant that binds all Jews together by virtue of their being different and apart from the rest of the world, whether they choose to be part of that or don't choose to be a part of that. All Jews, by virtue of the fact that they're Jews, share the same, quote, fate. All Jews have a shared, externally imposed historical experience. We all share that, which regretfully often was characterized by discrimination and intolerance, but thank God not always characterized that way. We are one people, all of us, bound together, whether we like it or not. Jewishness is a biological fact, or those converts who choose to join us, it is an identity into which mostly we are born. Is it not true, wrote Rabbi Soloveitchik, that, and this we see so often, that if one Jew does something wrong, then somehow all Jews get blamed. Everybody is in that boat. All Jews get reflected in an inappropriate way when one Jew does something wrong. Is it not true, wrote Rabbi Soloveitchik, that the Nazis persecuted all Jews equally, regardless of how pious or not pious that particular Jew may have been? And the biblical model for this covenant, the covenant of fate, is, as he described, the biblical model is the covenant, the experience in Egypt. All Jews were enslaved in Egypt. They didn't have a choice. All Jews were enslaved for one reason and one reason only, and that is because they were Jews. But then there's another covenant, and that is the covenant of destiny. This covenant is a covenant that revolves around a commitment to accept God's Torah. You remember, this is the Sinai covenant. This is the Torah, Jewish law, commitment to a Jewish way of life and living covenant. It's a covenant revolving around a commitment to live in accordance with that life, to live a life governed by the dictates of the Torah. This covenant is a chosen covenant. One chooses to enter into this covenant of a life of a Jewish law, what we call in Hebrew mitzvah, commandment observance. The biblical model for this covenant is the historical experience at Sinai, where Jews, according to rabbinic tradition, voluntarily consented to enter into this covenant with God, to accept God's Torah and to live by its dictates. So we have two covenants, covenant of fate and the covenant of destiny. Fate is automatic, destiny is chosen. Fate is passive, destiny is active. And therefore, for Rabbi Soloveitchik, Jewish identity is not exclusively defined by only commitment to Torah at Sinai, namely covenant of destiny, but it also includes, quite substantially, those who shared in the servitude in and redemption from Egypt, whether they live in accordance with the dictates of the covenant of destiny or not. With this notion of dual covenant, Rabbi Soloveitchik offers a construct that grants some measure of dignity and some measure of legitimacy to non-observant Jews. After all, they are full, absolutely full partners in the covenant of fate, and therefore they have a place in the legitimate place, in the broad construct or structure of the Jewish people. Now, to be sure, their status is not ideal. After all, they do not share in what we are now defining as the covenant of destiny, which for Rabbi Soloveitchik was essentially non-negotiable. That was absolutely crucial. But for him, they do have a place in the peoplehood of Israel as members of the covenant of fate. It's also important to note that the converse is also true. Source number 11. Rabbi Soloveitchik was, as we will see in a moment, an equal opportunity criticizer. An equal opportunity criticizer. He didn't only criticize those who lived the world of covenant of fate and not in destiny. He also criticized those who lived their lives in the covenant of destiny, but rejected the covenant of fate. Equal opportunity criticizer. Neither of these two categories alone was sufficient enough for Rabbi Soloveitchik. Source 11, a Jew participates in his people's suffering and fate, but does not bind himself to its destiny, which expresses itself in a life of Torah and, here's the Hebrew word again, mitzvot, commandments. In other words, somebody who is part of the covenant of fate, but not part of the covenant of destiny, violates a fundamental principle of Judaism. Conversely, and this is crucially important, for Rabbi Soloveitchik, quote, observant Jews shouldn't walk around and think, you know, I got it, I'm good, I'm pious, I'm observant, great. No, you're not done yet. You're not done yet. Conversely, a Jew does not grieve over the afflictions of his people, but seeks to separate himself from the Jewish faith, desecrates the holiness of Israel, even if he observes the commandments. Therefore, a Gentile who comes back full circle to the beginning of the presentation, who comes to attach herself or himself to the Jewish community, must accept upon himself the yoke of both covenants. Both. Remember the two questions. There's a covenant of destiny question, and there's a covenant of fate question, and both are important. Conversion consists in a person joining himself to both the people formed by the covenant in Egypt and the holy nation formed by the covenant at Sinai. Source number 12, the patriarchal covenant. Here he refers to the covenant of fate in another way. I told you before that there's not, like he didn't say, how did I call that? And he ran to the file cabinet and he pulled it out and he said, oh yeah, I remember, I called that covenant of fate. And then he runs back and he writes down covenant of fate. He's He's thinking all the time. So covenant of faith is called here patriarchal covenant. What does that mean? It comes down because we're children of the patriarchs. We are willy-nilly part of one community. The patriarchal covenant, or another way of saying covenant of faith, is realized within Jewish consciousness because others point at him and say he's a Jew. It's externally imposed upon you. You could want to be a Jew, not want to be a Jew, look like a Jew, not look like a Jew, but you're a Jew because they're going to call you a Jew. You're going to have the J on your passport stamped in no matter how pious you may or may not be. In a word, the patriarchal covenant finds expression in the sense of oneness with the Jewish people, in one's participation in the lot of all Jews, and in the consciousness of the fact that being Jewish is singular and unique. One who lacks this mentality and does not sense himself as bound to the strange, paradoxical Jewish fate lacks the sanctity of the patriarchal covenant. One may observe the Torah and mitzvot and be fully within the covenant of Sinai, yet at the same time profane the patriarchal covenant, the patriarchal sanctity. You can't just be fate, you have to be also destiny. You can't just be destiny, you have to be also fate. At the end of the day, source number 13, we need to be both. The individual and the community must come together through an act of historical identification of the past and future, the fate and destiny of the Jewish people. The individual and the community must come together. How did he refer to it? It's dialectical. Different ideas, different foci, different emphases, but we have to come together. Rabbi Soloveitchik's commitment to community was most profoundly reflected in his attitude towards Zionism and the State of Israel, and it is to that subject that we will turn our attention in the next unit. Thank you.
We met in this lecture a variety of different kinds of communities that Rabbi Soloveitchik saw himself a part of and that we could imagine ourselves a part of. The community of prayer, the community of charity. Do these communities come together and coalesce naturally? Or is there something that leaders and each individual that's a part of it, something that needs to happen for them to come into being?
There's a substantial debate and discussion in the world of sociology and psychoanalysis as to what extent is community a given function of the human being, or to what extent is it a construct? Freud, for example, placed a great deal of emphasis on the human being and the human being insofar as the human being relates to someone else. Anthony Storr, who was a British psychoanalyst, wrote a book a number of years ago entitled Solitude, in which he explicitly argued against what he considered to be the Freudian psychoanalytic overemphasis on relationships, on the other, and drew attention to the importance of solitude, the importance of somebody being alone. And in the world of sociology also, you know, what is the ultimate human being? Is it a human being alone, or is it a human being with others? I think that to some extent, community is a central aspect of the human condition. That in fact we cannot exist alone, and we cannot even exist within the construct of our own families. We need to have community to function. Not just that we need a farmer to give us tomatoes, and we need a doctor to fix our teeth, but for our very beings, our lives are enhanced and made whole, or made more whole by our engagement with others. Having said that, I think the kinds of communities, the construct of the substance of that community, needs to be cultivated carefully and thoughtfully. And they're not automatic, and they're not a given. That people feel the need to pray, I think, is clear. In the unit on prayer, I mentioned that Rabbi Soloveitchik uses that argument to justify the possibility of prayer. We can't live without prayer. Therefore, we must be able to pray, even though it may be challenging and complicated conceptually and experientially. But what a prayer community looks like needs cultivation. We want to study. We understand the need to study, to grow, to expand our knowledge. But what does a teaching community look like? We know that we want to give charity. We know that we're not selfish. We want to try to help someone else. But what does that community look like? What are its priorities? Who determines who gets what and how much needs to be cultivated? So I think it's a combination. It's a combination of what I do consider to be an innate human propensity and need for expanding outward, and direction as to exactly what the nature of what that will look like should be.